Welcome to another episode of the Mountain Bikes Apart podcast. This is a show about everything mountain biking, from kit guides to trail guides and everything in between. I'm Colin Gray, and I'm joined, as always, by Tom Bell. How you doing, Tom?
Hi, Colin. Yeah, good, thanks. How is things with you?
Not too bad, not too bad. Have you recovered from the lurgy you were talking about last time around?
Yeah, getting there. It's a slow progress. Slow process, and just sort of fighting the tail end of it off now. So yeah. back in training at least, which is right. The main thing.
You still feeling a bit ropey though?
Yeah, I've still sort of got a few of the symptoms there that I'm sort of keen not to push too much. Because I don't fancy another few weeks of it. Yeah. So just trying to be sensible.
Yeah. Well, there's a question for you then. So as a professional mountain biker, obviously this is your job to get this stuff done. How ill do you have to be to abandon your training program?
Yeah, I mean, I could still probably have pushed through it and got some fairly sort of decent training sessions out of the way. I was just trying to think more long term and do what I can to minimize the amount of time that I am ill.
Yeah,
when you're sort of training day to day, you think that when you take 2 or 3 days off, that everything's ruined and you're sort of back to being slow and you've lost all your shape. But the truth is that it comes back pretty fast, and you can be off for quite a long time and not lose heaps of fitness, or certainly that you can't get back within a week or two. So try to not be too hysterical about it when you do have to take time off.
So your philosophy is, if you're ill, if it's enough that you feel bad, then actually just stop, recover as quick as possible, and then get back to it properly after that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's whether I'm kind of trying to judge whether am I doing the training that I need to do if I'm too ill to get done what I kind of have planned and some of the goals and that kind of thing. It's just better not trying to half-ass it, kind of thing.
Right, so you don't do just some light stuff, because I know some people I know that do a lot of training. When they're ill, they'll just say, oh, I'll just jump on for 20 minutes and just, you know, keep up the fitness at least. You think that's a bit pointless?
I did jump out on the bike a little bit just to keep the muscles activated, keep moving, and kind of for a mental sanity kind of side of things as well, just to get outside. And I tried to do some gym work, so maintaining the core strength and lifting some weights and that kind of thing, which doesn't have you breathing too heavily and that kind of thing. So I tried to keep active, but not sort of prolong the illness by digging a hole for myself and driving myself into the ground.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Makes sense. I've seen the question come up quite a few times actually. Like, should you train through illness and all that? So must be something.
Yeah. I think generally they say that if it's above the neck, don't they? It's generally okay to keep riding at a fair, maybe a little bit of a reduced level, and then once it gets below the neck, sort of onto the chest, it's time to just take it really easy and let that sort of something like a chest infection really go away before you do anything too hard.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's considering you're breathing harder and need your lungs. Chest infection probably doesn't mix very well with exercise. Okay, cool. So last time around we mentioned the fact that this is basically you getting into the season proper now, isn't it? So you've got some races coming up, you must be getting into your training. So a couple of things I wanted to ask you. First of all, when it comes towards, or when you kind of transition from off season to on season, how does your training change? Does it change?
It does change. The silly thing is that the traditional kind of training or way that training would change is that you do sort of these big base miles in the winter to establish that kind of aerobic efficiency, aerobic base. And then you transition more towards specific training. So for me, as a cross-country racer, the specific training is more high intensity, you know, shorter rides and that kind of thing. And the annoying thing is that obviously in the UK, the weather's not that great in the winter when you're supposed to be doing the most amount of hours, which can be a bit tough to manage sometimes. But yeah, generally speaking, my training will start off less specific and more about establishing general fitness, and then it will transition more towards specific fitness for the actual races that I'm doing. So short, slightly shorter rides, slightly less volume, and more high intensity.
Right. So when you say specific fitness, you mean actually riding like you would in a race? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. So including some intervals. I still try to maintain a high volume sort of throughout the whole season, and always do some longer, lower intensity rides to keep that aerobic base sort of topped up, as it were. The intervals that I do are more, they become more geared towards what you would experience in a cross country race. So, you know, 30 seconds, a minute of hard over threshold kind of work, and then back down. And that kind of thing, just to build the VO2 max, build the functional threshold power, and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. All right. What races you got up and got coming up in the next couple of months? How does it start off? You said you missed one already. Is that right?
I did. Yeah. So unfortunately, I had to miss the first round of the British National Cross Country Series, which was down in South Wales. Just thought I'd be sensible and try to. Sort of focus more on getting a bit fitter and getting back to health. So the next round, the second round is down near Reading, on a sort of private wood, private estate. So that'll be the next race that I'll be doing, which is on the 23rd, I believe, of this month.
Yeah.
And then after that, I get on a plane again and go to Romania, of all places. It's not somewhere I've been before.
So what's going on in Romania?
So there's a UCI race out there. It's kind of a double-headed weekend where the very next day there's a UCI marathon race, which will act as a kind of qualifier to the World Championships. So I need a top 20 at that marathon race to qualify for the World Champs. So ambitious as it sounds, I'll be doing the sort of UCI cross country race on Saturday and then the marathon on the Sunday.
Right. Okay. Do you just interested, because you talk about going to all these events and stuff, and actually I want to talk a little bit about how you transitioned into being a pro racer as well, how you define that and all that.
Sure.
But just, it must be part of your, maybe you don't want to share this, but fair enough if you don't, but how do you pay for all of these things? Is that, do you pay for that yourself, or is that sponsors actually bringing you out to these types of races?
Yeah. So it's sort of sponsorship. So I do get money. I do get paid, which covers all the travel expenses, all the, you know, food, all the expenses that go along with a race. We also, as well, when we travel to these international races, we often contact the organizer, who's often willing to contribute to our flight costs and put us up in hotels and that kind of thing, to bring international races to the races. That was the case. Yeah. So that was the case with the Algarve Bike Challenge that we just talked about in the last podcast. Essentially it's paid for by corporate sponsors. So I've got a corporate sponsor that pays for that. And then there's obviously equipment sponsors as well that provide the stuff, which you can then, if you get to keep that equipment, you can then sell it on at the end of the year to recoup some more money and that kind of thing.
No, I'm just interested how it works. So it's to the benefit of the race organizers to have international racers there, I suppose. It makes their event look more legitimate. Is that right?
I think so. I think exactly. Yeah. So we did, when we were out at the Algarve, we did kind of a TV interview, and that went out on the Portuguese, TV channels and stuff. So like you say, I think it gives more sort of more clout maybe to these events when there's some international presence there.
Okay, well, that leads in pretty well to what I wanted to ask you about as well. It's something that's came up with a few listeners, with just myself as well, curious in terms of, you know, like, there's a lot of people I know who call themselves bike racers because they both mountain biking and road biking. A good friend of mine lives just a few doors round from me, and he used to do a lot of racing, but didn't get paid for it exactly, and had a traditional job at the same time.
Yeah.
So worked 9 to 5 daytimes, but did loads of training in the evenings and the weekends, and did races at the weekends too. Like, what's the difference? How do you transition, do you think? Or how do, maybe you're a little bit different because you've kind of gone into this straight as from youth level, I suppose, haven't you? Is that right?
Yeah, I kind of, it's a strange one because there isn't a direct sort of path.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a direct path to being a professional. And
yeah.
like you've alluded to as well, there's a bit of a loose definition with the word professional. Mm-hmm. I'm not a professional in the sense that I get a full-time wage that just, pays for me completely to live and all that kind of thing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm a professional in a sense that I get money from companies to race my bike, but
yeah.
It's not like I'm completely living off that money. And there are some, obviously there are the top athletes that do that. Generally in the mountain bike cross country, they're the sort of top 30 in the World Cup. The sort of top 30 in the world will be on some kind of full-time wage, whether that's from their team, sponsor or their team or their national federation as well. If they've got Olympic programs and that kind of thing. So speaking in the UK, there's essentially one guy. So Grant Ferguson, who's Scottish and he's the national cross country champion. He's kind of our main fully fledged professional.
Right.
He went to the Rio Olympics and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then basically in the UK, at least, everyone else is kind of on the kind of similar sort of deals that I am, I think, in terms of getting money to pay for expenses and maybe a little bit more on top of that, and then support from bike shops and bike sponsors. But a lot of them, have some sort of supplementary income, whether that's a full-time job or something part-time and flexible.
Yeah. So, I mean, and you have to search for your own sponsors, don't you? You've talked to me a few times about going out on that sort of almost a sales trail.
Indeed. Yeah, exactly. So I'm a bit funny in that I like to have my own program and just choose the sort of sponsors that I want to work with. So I could apply to be on some kind of established team, which would be good in a number of ways. But I like to just try and approach different companies myself and offer sort of a tailored package for each and work with different the companies that I kind of am interested in working with. So it's definitely a harder way to go and more time consuming, but sometimes it's really fulfilling and it's nice to sort of partner with these different sort of interesting companies.
Yeah. Who was your first sponsor?
I think my first proper sponsor was probably a Spanish bike company called MSC. And they make really, really nice sort of high-end carbon and aluminium bikes. Pretty small company based in Barcelona. Uh-huh. And I spoke to their kind of distributor in the UK and was partnered with them for a little while. So I really enjoyed riding their bikes.
Is that when you think you transitioned into being, or your mindset, you were suddenly a professional biker at that point? Or when did you think that changed?
I think, it may be in my head. That's what I was trying to sort of aim towards. I guess once I left university, so I won the university sort of British University Championships, and kind of decided after that, once I'd left university, that I was going to try and see how far I could take it, and try to go towards national championships and world championships, going into the Commonwealth Games and Olympic Games. And so essentially from there, I've just been trying to get better every year and try and work up that ladder, so to speak.
Yeah. So right now you're almost a self-managed team, aren't you?
Indeed, of
just you, and you organize your own sponsors. You're almost your team manager as well.
Yeah.
That's how you make your own money. That's how you pay for your kit, your trips. You get some extra from the organizers too. What's the next level up, do you think? You say you wouldn't want to, or you prefer not to ride for a team, but what would it take for you to join a team then?
Yeah, so this is something I sort of think about quite a lot as well. And I guess the main thing I've got to focus on is trying to get my results just, you know, better and better. Mm. And everything else kind of falls into place after right. that, because okay. that gives you more notoriety, gives you more, you know, publicity, and you're more well known as your results improve.
Yeah.
So I try to focus on that as the principle, just trying to get faster and get better results at national and international events. And I guess from there, you'd then maybe have a better proposition to go to corporate sponsors. So maybe you could get more money, yeah. More support from them if I still wanted to run my own program.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
It is an individual sport. I mean, they have teams, all the World Cup sort of level. At the World Cup level, they all have teams, and they're all generally supported by a bike company. So you'll have Trek Factory Racing or BMC Racing or Cannondale Factory Racing. But once they're in the race, all those racers are racing, you know, for an individual place. There's not really any team tactics going on. So it can still work as an individual sport and someone that's supported individually. But obviously, there's a lot of support, a lot of resources with these these sort of factory teams. So I guess once you got to that level, it would be more, it would be better and far easier logistically to join an established team.
Yeah. I mean, well, the thing that occurs to me is whether could you get better quicker? Could you improve those results quicker with a team, do you think, if they were taking care of the logistics and helping you with your training and stuff? Or do you think you're doing well enough as it is?
I definitely think that's the sort of next stepping stone towards really high performance when everything's taken care of for you.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm still at the stage. I'm definitely still at the stage where I'm trying to get to a level that I would be kind of accepted onto a big UCI team like that. So.
Sure.
I think I still, and every rider is, generally speaking, unless they've gone straight into a national federation program, if you're doing it on your own, you kind of need to get to those results before that kind of team setup becomes a reality. And at this stage, I just don't feel like some of the teams that I would perhaps join would help enough in that kind of logistical side of things. Yeah. It would be more just, you know, a lot of equipment being given and that kind of thing. So
But once you think once you get to a sort of your next level in terms of results and stuff like that, that actually joining a team at that point is more worthwhile, because, well, it's presumably because they would reward you better because you're kind of a higher level rider, and they would give you the better training, and that's kind of the next stepping stone. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in terms of the training, I'm alongside kind of doing all the racing and having the sponsorship and stuff, I coach a lot of riders. So that's kind of my supplementary kind of job and career. So I'm quite sort of up and reading all the leading edge training stuff. So I'm fairly fine with coaching myself. And even at the very top level, there's a lot of self-coached athletes. So it would be more on the logistical side and the sort of, salary and equipment side of things. So it's just when it ticks over to being worth it, sort of on that side of things, I think would be the point of change.
No, thanks for sharing that. It's really interesting, actually. It's because it's not really that transparent in how it all works, I suppose, especially in in Britain particularly, we have these sports where there are definite pros. You know, you play football, for example, in a Premiership team or something, and you get paid a decent wage, and that is your job all the time, and all you do is train and play, and that's it. But a sport like mountain biking, sadly, like you say, there's only one proper professional in the whole of the UK at this, from what you're saying. So shows that it's probably not the most supported sport. So people kind of obviously have to make their own take their own path, I suppose, in some ways, and make their own jobs, like through sponsorship and coaching and doing stuff like this as well. I mean, like running this podcast with me and writing a blog and things like that. So it's really interesting to get a kind of background on how it all works, how it ties together, because there must be a lot of people out there listening who love the idea of mountain biking for a living, even if it's not racing. Maybe it's the coaching side of things. Maybe that's something we should cover a wee bit in the future, actually.
Yeah, sure.
How you could be a professional coach, because I've done some training in that years back as well. So actually, yeah, if you're out there listening, if you want to know a bit more about that side of things, because we could probably delve really deep into that, like how you can make money out of mountain biking, all the different jobs that you can do in mountain biking, if you thought you wanted to turn it from a hobby into a job. But I know there's probably lots of people out there who have absolutely no interest in doing that. They just love it as a hobby. So, but if you do want to hear that, give us a tweet, send me a tweet over to on Twitter at the podcast host. Let me know if that's something you'd like to hear about, and we could maybe do a couple of episodes on that in future. Okay, cool. That was good. Yeah, I've been curious about asking you for that for a while, and been waiting for an episode where we could fit it in. So,
right, cool.
Right, let's do a listener question. So we've got one in from Greg Pooley, who was asking about a particular type of bike. So Greg wrote in and asked about the best budget full suspension bike that you can find. And you and him had a couple of back and forths via email, didn't you? So I just wanted to cover that in the show because I thought there was some good stuff in there.
Yeah.
So it starts, well, let me read out his question first. This is from Greg Pooley. Do you have a list of the best options for a full suspension cross-country stroke all mountain bike? Price range would be close to $1,000 US. What I'm actually looking for is one for my 12-year-old son who'll start racing cross-country this year, and one for myself that will be riding with him. I, however, want something comfortable and easy to climb. Anything will go downhill fast enough for me. So this is a really common question. This is someone I used to get in all the time through the website. And in fact, it's why I wrote the, if you're interested in a kind of wider answer to this, Greg and anyone else out there, we've got on mountainbikesapart.com, which is the website for this show, we've got on there something called the What Mountain Bike Guide. And that guide is about 10, 15 pages long, just going through how to choose a mountain bike, what mountain bike will suit you. It gives recommendations for, you know, top five all mountain, top five cross country, top five under 500, top five under 1,000. So there's lots of recommendations in there, but great to chat. It'll be great to get your opinions on this as well, Tom, just on the show here. Sure. So he is looking for under $1,000, one that will suit a kid who's starting to race cross country, and for him to be able to keep up with his kid, by the sounds of it. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so like you said, me and Greg had a little bit of discourse over email, and essentially my kind of response to him was that obviously a full suspension is going to be a great bike, but at around $1,000, which was his budget, it might be worth, and especially for his son, looking more at a kind of hardtail bike to start off with, just because you're going to get a little bit more bang for your buck, so to speak. So you're just going to get a better frame, a better suspension fork, without having to worry about putting some of that budget into a rear shock and all the complexity that comes with a full suspension frame.
Yeah.
And for his son as well, being 12 years old, that kind of reduced weight that you'll find going from a full suspension to a hardtail is going to be a lot more noticeable. It's going to allow him to maneuver the bike and climb hills a lot better, because the additional kilograms or the additional weight of the bike is going to be a higher percentage of, you know, his total weight as a rider and bike. So it's going to be a lot more noticeable than that of an adult. So that was kind of my main opinion on that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know, would you agree, Colin? Would you say the same sort of thing?
I think so as well. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially cross-country racing, if he's wanting to be serious about the racing in particular, I mean, a lot of cross-country racers use hardtails, don't they? They've gone back because of the simplicity, because of the weight and all that kind of stuff. I think I've asked you this before, haven't I? Are most on hardtail rather than full sus?
Most are actually going to quite a lot. There's a move definitely more towards full suspension now.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, with the courses getting more technical and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
At the same, but at the same time, they're obviously very high priced, very lightweight carbon bikes. So when you're still kind of in the realms of aluminium and a lower budget, then the simplicity, as you said, of a hardtail and the lower weight is a lot more noticeable.
So our level, And I mean, do you know what? I moved back. I've talked about this a couple of times in the show. I moved back to a hardtail last year for a few different reasons. Simplicity, a big part of it. Cost, I could get a lot more for my money. But it still wasn't a huge effect, actually. It was more just the fact that I find a hardtail bike can just make me go further. I enjoy the exploring and getting around, and I just feel like it's, it's great for that. For that budget, I would totally agree. It's just, you could get yourself a full sus. I think maybe Canyon bikes, we talked about this, didn't we, do a full sus for less than that. But it probably is very low end of the range. It's maybe not going to last as long, even though they're a pretty good brand. I'd be really tempted just to buy, especially if your kid's going to race. He's going to be taking this quite seriously. You want something that's going to last a couple of years, take a lot of pounding if he's going to start training and stuff like that. And a good hardtail is going to be far better value than a very average or even bad full sus. So that would be my thoughts on it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking. And some of the other kind of suggestions that I made were to maybe look at like some last year's kind of bikes that essentially will be just a slight upgrade in terms of some slightly newer components and a different paint job. Essentially they're all very similar. They're all going to be great bikes, and you can get them for a substantial amount of money less, with it just being 1 or 2 years older. And Canyon are definitely a good one to check out, because with them being direct to consumer, there's no kind of distributor taking a cut in the middle. You just get very, very good value, and the components that you would get on a Canyon bike, the equivalent from one of the bigger companies, would be a lot more expensive. And I believe Canyon are coming to the US, which is I think where Greg is based. They may have already moved over there, but I know they're coming very soon. So definitely Canyon's a good one to check out.
Yeah, cool. I mean, the standards, the thing is, we can tell you a few of the kind of secret brands that are really good in the UK. Like we've got, I feel like On One are a really good brand, but they're not, I don't think they're in the US. You might get them in the US. You could probably get some secondhand ones out there in the US, maybe. You'll get great value with them. Even with White's, another sort of UK based company, Orange as well. It's great, but am I getting that right? Orange is UK based, isn't it?
They are. They're based in Halifax, quite near me, actually, in Halifax. And I believe they've just they are also another company that have just gone to the US recently. So that's cool. A good option.
Yeah. What's the Orange? There's an Orange cross country bike that people swear by. Is it the it's a number 426 or something like that? The summer. Like, it's got a nickname.
I'm not 100% sure, actually.
There's a hardtail. I think it's 426. I can stick it in the show notes afterwards if you want to go and check it out. We could put it in the show notes. We'll link to it. You can find the show notes at mountainbikesapart.com/307 for episode 7. You'll find a link to it over there. But I think it's called the Orange 426 something to do with summer. That's useless. Should have looked at that beforehand. But it's a really good bike for all purpose riding, and it would be good for a cross country racing anyway. Great quality. But I mean, if you don't spot any of them, Greg, and anyone else out there listening looking for a bike like this, I mean, it's hard to go wrong. You can't go wrong with the standard brands like Specialized, Trek, Cannondale, Giant, and like you say, Tom, look for last season's ones, and you'll get a complete bargain on some of those brands, because people that follow those brands are so kind of fashion conscious.
Yeah,
they'll get rid of their 2017 bikes. a year later. So you can buy a secondhand one of these bikes for like less than half the price of a new one, and it'll be perfectly good condition. Maybe just need a wee service, a couple of little upgrades, and you'll get this really, really good bike for very little.
Or
again, like you mentioned, Tom, like just go to the shops and look for last season, and they'll be like 30, 40, 50% off even. Hope that helps. So hope that was useful, Greg. And we hope to hear news of your son going out and winning some races this summer. That'd be good to hear.
Absolutely, yeah. That'd be great.
Cool. Okay. And I hope you can keep up with him as well. Let us know. Do keep us updated. Send in a wee email or a follow-up in a few months' time. Let us know what you did get, and we can report back to everyone on what you went with, how you're finding it as well. You can give us a wee review and how you're managing to keep up yourself. Alrighty, I think that'll do it for another week, Tom.
Cool. Yeah, I think we've talked about some interesting stuff. Yeah,
hope so.
Yeah.
We'd hope to good hear your feedback though out there in listener land. So if you're listening, let me know. We've been doing the last couple of months since the sort of turn of the year, we've been doing these kind of updates, a bit more general, answering some listener questions, what we're up to just now, covering a few random topics. So it'd be good to hear how you're finding this type of show, because in the past we've done season-based shows where we've covered, you know, a particular topic. So season two of the show was how you customize a bike for yourself. So how you choose a bike and then make sure it's really well suited to you, like all the different components, how you make it, you know, perfect for your own context, the type of riding you do. So I quite enjoy doing those kind of seasons because we can plan it ahead. We can treat it almost like a course, and you end up with a bunch of episodes all tied together and really teach you something in depth. So we could go back to that. We could do another season of that in the next few months if everybody's interested in that. So let me know what you prefer. Easiest way is by Twitter. Just go to twitter.com and get me on the podcast host and send me a tweet and let me know what you think. What type of episodes do you want to hear in the future? Because you want to make stuff that people want to listen to. Equally, if you have any questions, any comments, you want to send us anything to put on the show, send it in. You can do that via email as well, colin@mountainbikesapart.com. And the last wee ask I'll make, I've not mentioned it in a while, is reviews. So as you know, one of the biggest ways that people listen to podcasts is on iTunes. Now, I know a lot of you out there will be listening on something else, like Android or something like that. But I bet you, even if you're on Android, it's likely you'll have an Apple account, either for a Mac or for, I don't know, an iPad that you use on the side or something like that. And if you do, if you are either an iOS user, or you have an Apple account for iTunes Store or whatever, if you can pop onto the iTunes Store, type into the search box mountainbikesapart.com or just mountainbikesapart podcast. Our podcast will pop up there. And if you click on the podcast in the search results, you'll see that there's a little review button right below the title. And if you could pop in a review for us, I would so appreciate that. If you just take the time to do that, it'd be amazing, because it's such a good way to get the show out to more people. It helps us gather more listeners, make the show better, get more questions and more feedback, all that kind of stuff. Helps us make the show bigger and better for you. So if you can pop on there, find us on iTunes, give us a star rating and a review. You can give an honest one. If you think we're rubbish, give us a one star. Hopefully you'll be giving us five stars hopefully, and even if you just give it the star rating rather than a review, that's great too. So if you can do that, I'd appreciate it. I haven't mentioned it in a while, so I hope you don't mind me going through it for a few minutes again. Anyway, what have you got coming up this week, Tom? Anything exciting? Oh no, it's Friday today, so anything this weekend?
I think we've got some friends around this evening, so I'll just be out training the rest of the day, and then we've got that this evening, and then I'm not sure over the weekend. Cool. Plenty of training as usual, but yeah. should have something exciting going on, I'm
specific,
sure.
Yeah. We're heading to Aileth, actually. There's a mountain bike trail at Aileth, because there's a few of our friends coming down. It's a friend of my wife, really, but I'm good friends with her husband as well now, and he's really into his bike, and he's more of a downhiller. So we're going to go up to Aileth Pump Track, and he's got his 9-year-old daughter really into it, so we're going to go up there, take the bikes up, and try and get the kids to go around the trail a few times so that we can try and sneak a few rides ourselves. So
that sounds cool. I'll have to check that out, actually. I don't think I'm familiar with that trail, so
it's just a tiny wee thing. Like it's one downhill skills loop, which is maybe all of 400, 500 meters long. Takes you less than, you can get down it in less than a minute if you're moving. And then it's got a pump track, which you can just sort of zoom around and do some tricks on and just sort of up your skills a wee bit. And then it's got one downhill section if you ride up the hill a bit, which takes maybe 2 or 3 minutes to get down. So it's good fun. It's like, it's not a full day out, but you can go up there for a couple of hours with the kids and have a good time and still get some decent riding
things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's good fun. Plenty of tabletops and doubles and all that kind of stuff.
Cool.
So, yeah. All right. Well, that'll do it for another episode. Thanks again for spending time with us. Thanks for giving us your ears for however long this has been, 35 minutes. And if you can come back again next time, that'd be brilliant. We'll see you then. Talk to you next week.
Catch you soon.